I know everybody in Montana has heard about and knows what a wolf is. And so that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. And that's kind of what I've dedicated my life to, believe it or not. But the longer you do something, the more you think you have to learn. And that's certainly my case. And so what I want to say before I get going is, even though this lecture series is about science, and there was a time period in my life when I felt science could save the world, and it's the best way of knowing, it is so hard to do science with wolves. They are so value-laden, opinion-laden. It's kind of how you grew up, how you think about wolves, what you choose to believe about wolves, how they should be managed. So I'm going to twist and turn through that a little bit tonight, because you're an audience coming on a winter night, which is the time of year wolves love the most, and you live amidst wolves. So your voice and your thinking are really, really important. And I'm a little concerned. I'm by nature a pessimist. Many colleagues of mine are like, geez, Doug, 50 years ago, we would have never been able to do this. And here we are, we have 2,000 wolves in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. So why am I thinking this way? So I'm going to talk through this, but my talk now, years ago, used to just be straight science. And now if we're going to get anywhere, I got to back off of that. And so let's see how it goes. And so first and foremost, you can look into those eyes and you can read that poetry at the bottom, which is Robert Service, the poet of the North, Yukon Territory. The mountains are a part of me, I'm fellow to the trees. This is an animal of myth, legend, fable, presence. Have you ever been around and, you know, someone walks in the room and everything changes? That's a wolf. That's a wolf. And that's what we're dealing with. So rational thought, realism, science is way down the list. It's those eyes that do it. And so why here? Why now? I know so many of you living here love it. You wouldn't want to live anywhere else. More people are coming. This area is growing. But it's one of the greatest complexes of public lands in the United States. I don't know this for sure, but I've heard it referred to enough times, it might be the most intact temperate zone ecosystem in the world. And it's anchored by Yellowstone National Park, where I work, and wolves were reintroduced in 1995, 96, and 97. They spread out to the entire ecosystem. And a simultaneous, I call it our sister effort, took place in central Idaho. And wolves came into northwest Montana on their own. I'll show that in a minute. And so this is a great wildland. Living here, you should be proud of it. You know, throwaway quotes are sometimes good, sometimes not. But, you know, the Bible, pride cometh before the fall. Never be proud. But you should be proud that you live here in such a place. And wolves are the missing link. And now they're back. But the history of Yellowstone has not always been pristine. 1872, this was a howling wilderness. And so many, many people think because Yellowstone was the first park in the world, something for sure we should be proud of, and it is America's best idea, that, and because it's never been logged, grazed, or mined, that it's been pristine its entire history. That's not true. Talking to Lee Whittlesey, who just retired, the park's historian, probably 100 years before park establishment, there were changes due to European humans already underway. Fur trade, market hunting, predator control, fire suppression, bison ranching, control of the elk, just to name a few. I'm sure I'm leaving out some. And the Park Service came along in 1916, was more founded on scenic beauty than it was on ecological integrity. In fact, we didn't know what ecology meant to the 1930s. I don't think the word ecosystem came about till about then. For sure, wildlife management didn't come about till then, because that was Aldo Leopold. And so Yellowstone preceded all this, and wolves did not have a place. nor did other predators. So Yellowstone was a very disturbed place for a very long time. And this is Yellowstone too. And that's actually a coyote pelt, but you get the idea. Guy with a rifle, pistol pointed at the pelt, using a broom like a rifle. This is what people thought about predators. And you know, in a lot of ways, a lot hasn't changed. A lot of people are still that way. And that's what I'm talking about when I say you're invited to a talk to deal with science. And I say at the outset, I'm going to back off that. So think hard. How do we get there? How do we get to the facts? And so this is what I think is part of what we're talking about. And this is very much a mix of science and humans. And that we conquered the world. We won. The world exists at our leisure. And I'm not sure that's a good thing, but that's the facts. And yet, wolves resist that. And that's one reason we killed them for so long. They represent wildness in the truest form. Just look at those eyes that I showed you. You should feel what it's to be in the presence of a wolf. When we were reintroducing them in 95, 96, we brought them in trucks, in crates, and people could hardly see into those crates, yet they would walk up to them and have their picture taken next to it and go, I could see the eyes through the holes in the crate. And just the feel of this magnificent animal right there. That's what I'm talking about when I say nature preservation. And we can't have just things that are convenient to us. We have to have the hard things like wolves. And boy, they're hard, as you all know, you're Montanans. So how's this come about? We have not added more wolf habitat since 1872. It's decreased, yet we got wolves now. And we used to not. So what happened? This is what happened. People's minds changed. And I have no idea how you do that. I really don't. They tell me TV shows have more impact upon people's minds, thoughts, values. But how you get these cultural norms to move about is a mystery to me. But that's kind of what happened. Now only half the people hate wolves. And I guess that's progress. And so this is why I'm a little bit still of a pessimist. I've showed this slide a fair bit now. It was on Facebook, but to me this is deeply disturbing. And that's what I'm worried about, that human attitudes have not completely changed. There's still a way to go. And I work hard to be a moderate, a middle-of-the-road type of person. I know those are uninteresting personality types, kind of vanilla-type people. But with wolves, you have to be. But I still find this disturbing. And this is disturbing, too. This is Northwest Territories in the late 1950s, early 1960s. This is wolves stacked up like cordwood. They were all poisoned. I've been in Northwest Territories many times. Done several canoe trips there. It's about as wild as you can get. Yet in the 50s and 60s, they're poisoning wolves because of these attitudes I'm talking about. And we got that now here. You know, just listen to the debate about wolves. It's not oftentimes very scientific or rational or logical. So, and again, for me to tell you guys what to do would be very improper for a lecture on science. So I just want you to think about this. I'm just presenting these ideas to you. So what is the big deal? Well, we hunt, they hunt. They hunt the same things we hunt. And that's been going on for thousands of years. Elk and deer primarily around here. And, you know, to be honest, I wish scientific studies one size fits all, but they don't. Every little system is different. Sometimes wolves do have an impact. And sometimes killing them will get you more elk and deer. That's true. But sometimes it doesn't. A colleague of mine studied wolves in the Yukon Territory for 20 years. He killed 850 wolves. He collared 350. It was a government-sponsored program to just do one thing, find out if wolf control works. Sometimes it does. And when there's another limiting factor, like the wolves that lived in the southwestern Yukon that had big snows coming off the Pacific Ocean. The limiting factor was not wolves. It was winter weather. So killing wolves didn't do a daggum thing to getting more moose and dull sheep and caribou. But yet Alaska's full speed ahead on this. It's state law on state land to maximum have game at maximum sustained yield. And maybe this is controversial to say this, but that's like managing your wildlife like livestock. And that's the last frontier. Yet they're treating their wildlife like livestock, killing predators, wolves and bears primarily. Human safety, much overblown. Wolves aren't dangerous to people. They're probably the least dangerous of all the big carnivores. I won't go into that in great depth, but there's a lot of data on that. The health issue, they do have hydatid tapeworm cyst. It comes out in eggs in their feces, and there's mist that float around. If you see a wolf in your field and it defecates, and you walk through that field and get it on your shoes and come inside, you've brought the eggs in, you're going to spread that disease to family members. And that's never happened. The only case I'm aware of, someone getting a hydatid tapeworm cyst in North America, were some Aboriginal people who lived with their sled dogs and fed them caribou innards, organs where the cysts form, and the dogs eat them, and they're living amidst the feces constantly, and a native woman got hydatid tapeworm cyst. That's the only case I'm aware of. So it's really hard to get. If you're hunting wolves, I would wear gloves when I'm around their rear end, just as a precaution. But this is far from a human health hazard. And then, of course, there's livestock, and that's a big one. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time with that because I don't have a lot of experience with it. But that's kind of a black and white issue. When wolves kill livestock, they get killed. That's not tolerated. If I'm a rancher and I have wolves around, I'm going to have sleepless nights. I understand that. So that's a big problem. So those are the big three. And, you know, it's not that bad. There's a lot of species of wildlife that I think there's a harder, longer list. A colleague of mine in India studies tigers. And tigers kill people. And they don't kill the tigers when they do it. A lot of times they're like, you know, that guy should have known that female had lost the male in the area and she was uptight. And so as soon as the new male came back, she'd calm down again. That was his fault. Could you imagine someone in the U.S. talking like that? And so my friend Jala said, wolves are more controversial. And secondly, people in India can't pick up their phone and call a U.S. senator and get them on the phone. So this is a big deal. I jumped ahead and I talked about this a little bit already, but this is going back. This was the plan. No wolves here, except Northwest Montana. Wolves moved in 1979. First den in 1986. The idea there was to nurture them, Endangered Species Act, and then reintroduce two populations in Yellowstone and central Idaho. And the idea was to have those three populations merge. And long story short, that's pretty much happened. So we have 2,000 wolves in the area. All three states hunt wolves. I'll talk a little bit about wolf hunting in a minute. And so, you know, I've given a lot of wolf talks in my career. And the first 10 years, I had this talk in every slide. And I took it out for 10. And now I'm on a five-year jag where I'm putting it back. Because this is getting to be history. This is the first wolf coming into Yellowstone. This is the Secretary of the Interior carrying him in. That's the Director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're carrying them in front. You know, Yellowstone is one of the greatest conservation theaters in the world. And Yellowstone by itself draws attention and headlines. You throw in wolves, you get the Secretary of the Interior coming. Shortly after this, President Clinton came. And it wasn't just a park visit, it was to see the wolves. So this is a big deal. And so again, after dinner and you know, I'm on squishy ground talking about science, but you need to get a little background. This is the wolf pop. We're adding up our numbers now, and the numbers are actually down this year, about 80 wolves in Yellowstone. But wolves from 95 to about 2007 bounced around quite a bit. They hit 174. So now down around 80, it's quite a bit less. There are three disease outbreaks in those early years. 2 years ago, we had another disease outbreak. That was distemper. And that really lowers pup survival. But if they live through it, they're immune lifetime to it. But since about 2007, 2008, we have been flat, just dead flat. The wolf population has not fluctuated much, hovering around 100 wolves in 10 packs. That's really interesting. And, you know, just eyeballing this, and there's nothing special about this at all. A lot of science is done this way. No stats, you just eyeball. I'm calling the period on the your left, phase one, the period on the right, the stability, phase two. And when I go to scientific conferences and present this very simple graph, a lot of scientists say to me, what's going to be phase three? So that's very, will they just stay flat like this? Or are they going to start bouncing around? Really interesting question. And we should do it because 80% of wildlife studies are 3 to 5 years. And these long-term studies reveal and teach us so much because they get below the surface. And so, and given the controversy of wolves, if we don't do something, people will make it up. But more on that in a minute. That was not intended to be a joke. Again, you're catching me a little bit off guard. I was out of work for 5 weeks, too. So we don't have these last two figures updated. This is a territory map from 2017. It should say 2018, but it's roughly the same. The big change would be in the south. Snake River Pack's kind of gone. The pack that's moved in is the Huckleberry Pack, but they live more outside the park, although they denned in. Cougar's still there. Canyon's gone. Wapiti's still there. Molly's is still there. That's our longest living pack in Yellowstone, 1995 to the present. Really interesting story there. Wish I could talk more about it, but I got to keep going. Lamar Canyon's there, uncollared. You know about them because we just lost a very significant wolf there, 926, got legally harvested. Junction Butte's still there. Prospect Peak gone. 1108s, we've renamed Crevice Lake Pack, and 8 Mile is still there. And right now it's February. This is the heart of the breeding season. And so I don't really want to get into recent updates because if there's anything that makes Yellowstone interesting compared to wolves across North America is even though our numbers are down, the Yellowstone wolf population kind of operates at least in the north at fairly high density. And so wolves respond to that density. And the main thing it does, that means they're proximate to other wolves a lot of the time. And so during the breeding season, they move around and mix up a lot. It's their chance to prove their social position. So when you have a potential mate over the hill, like in Yellowstone, you might go there. In the Northwest Territories, or the North Slope of the Yukon Territory, there's no wolf over the next hill. It's a few hundred miles. Because our wolf density is about 30 to 40 wolves per 1,000 square miles. The density where I just said is probably 5 wolves per 1,000 square miles. So that makes wolves do different things behaviorally and socially. And so that's a very important point that kind of puts Yellowstone in place. And so this is the big controversy. You guys are Montanans. Who are the gods around here? Well, besides people. The elk. The elk. They're the ones everybody wants and is concerned about. So this is arguably one of the most studied elk populations in North America, the Northern Yellowstone elk herd. There's actually data going back in park records on this herd since the late 1800s. And I'm just picking it up here in the early 1960s. And in 1935, at least reading Adolf Murray's book about coyotes, he has a section in there, a little small section about elk. But Doug Houston book's better. And this isn't, they have slightly different views of this, but around 1935 to 1968, the park was controlling elk. So you can see that period there at the far left of the graph. That was the elk population held down because of the Park Service. And again, the best source is Doug Houston, his Northern Yellowstone Elk book. I've added his table up a few times, but it's around 77,000 elk were killed by the Park Service, killed by Montana hunters, or shipped out across the lower 48, Canada, and Mexico. Yellowstone elk were shipped everywhere. Probably more appropriately, Wyoming elk, Northwest Wyoming. Wyoming Wildlife just had an article about this. But they were shipped all over. And because we killed off the predators. So 68, that Park Service policy changed. And look what happened. Elk population erupted. And so we had the misfortune of reintroducing wolves right at the peak of that graph. So the population really couldn't do anything else but go down. And that's what it did. And everybody says that's the wolf effect. So this is one of my hardest graphs to explain, because how can the graph here to the far right, 6,000 to 7,000 elk, that's counted elk, by the way, here. You want to add 30%. We call that sightability correction. How can fewer elk be better than over 20,000 to 25,000 elk? Remember, this is America. We're consumers. More is always better. This over here on the right is ecology, where less is more. That is an incredibly hard thing to communicate to American audiences. How can fewer elk be better? You, many of you, are probably incredulous that I would say such a thing. But Yellowstone, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, it has probably environmentally and ecologically changed. I hate to put value judgments on nature. We shouldn't. But I'll say it briefly, for the better. So tough to explain. And this is another way to look at it. This is not fancy statistics. The horizontal axis is elk abundance, just those counts that I showed you. The vertical axis is the number of wolves. And you can see on the right, the yellow color is early years, the green color is later years. And you can see that every year early on, it was like a crapshoot where the elk population and wolf population are going to be the next year. Very, very unstable. Look what's happened the last few years. It's zeroed in, as those bar graphs showed, on stability. So again, value judgments on nature are bad, but there's something going on here that suggests, I dare say it, restoration. And importantly, this was not all wolves. But cougars were killed off. They were done. We don't know the exact date. Wolves, 1926. Cougars, sometimes in the 30s. And they came back on their own. And, you know, I'm not trying to buy wolves public favor, but you should see the kill rate on a mama cougar when she's got kittens. It makes wolves look like pedestrians. Her weekly toll is something. You know, so you add them to the list, and you add these guys to the list. Now, they've always been there, but they've increased in distribution primarily, as you know, because you're such astute ecosystem inhabitants, but also some of their densities have increased. You know, Yellowstone, 1970, roughly 100 bears in the park. Now we have probably 250, you know, double the number of wolves, way more than wolves. And they take a lot of elk calves and dead bison that get killed during the rut, like this big male had. And the other big change that's occurring, and I'll just mention this in passing, I hate to admit it because it's seeming like a long time now, but I got to Yellowstone in 1994, and there are 500 bison in the Northern Range. Now there's over 3,500. And so we've spent the last 25 years primarily studying wolf-elk relationships, and I've touched on those. Again, after dinner talking, I didn't want to go into deep, although I have a graph coming up I'm a little worried about. I'm going to have to go through it quickly. It summarizes all our elk research in one graph. But bison is the new story with that many bison, how that's going to interact. And wolves hate killing them. We wrote a paper on this. They're more abundant in the winter than elk, and yet the wolves are still choosing the elk. I mean, and that doesn't take much thinking. If you had a choice and only your teeth to do the job with, who would you kill? And so we're studying the elk too. And this, since 2011, or slightly before, I became more involved with elk in Yellowstone, and we ramped up that work. And again, I'm a big fan of long-term research, the long, slow burn, and the things that reveal themselves, because I was involved with the Isle Royale Wolf Research, if you know where that is, and I won't go into it because I'm running out of time, but for 15 years. And that study's been going continuously since 1958. And they would characterize every decade as being different. So the answers change. And the public hates that because we like straight, clear answers. And when you change the answer because you learn more, people think you're lying. I've been accused of that a lot. No, it's just you learn more. And remember the other thing too, when you're trying to study nature, they never reveal the truth to you, ever. Everything you do is an estimate. If we could walk out and talk to the wolves and find out what's going on, heck, I don't even know if that would work, because if I went and talked to you guys, I'm not sure I would get a good bead on reality either. So these are tough things to do. So we have 100 elk on the air, all females. So go the females, so go the herd. I'm not trying to read anything into that, but that's just the slow burn with elk. And so we're doing that now continuously. And this is the one graph that I'm going to have a great deal of trouble with, but I'll try and do it quickly. But this is a lot of time, effort, and money in this one graph. So let me explain it to you quickly. The yellow is the age distribution of the elk that are alive out there. The white bars are the age distribution of the elk that wolves kill. So they are selecting against prime age elk. Prime age elk are the ones having the babies every year. And the older elk are easier for the wolves to kill. They're not as productive. And those are where the wolves are focusing their time. And so that's reflected in that pink curve. So we put a radio collar on the female elk, and we calculate their annual survival rate. And during their prime years, they're Teflon. Nothing kills them. And then at about 10 to 12, they start getting vulnerable. They start dipping down. And then around 12 to 14, and the black line, actually 10 to 12 too, is their pregnancy rate. So the reason why the black line dips so hard is because when you're a mama elk and you have a baby, that calf's gonna nurse on you all summer. And so and the cost of lactation is 4 times the cost of gestation. And so that's a big energy drain. And mama has to get to about 10% body fat. Now she can get to 20% body fat, but she's got to get to 10% body fat by next fall in order to be able to conceive her next calf. When you're young, you can do it. When you're old, you can't. So those cows start doing alternate year reproduction. They have a calf every other year. And those are the elk, at least cow elk. I won't talk about calves and bulls, but at least for cows, those wolves are focusing on cow elk. And I am not that great of a statistician, but I can calculate a mean pretty well. And dadgummit, I cannot believe the average age of cow elk killed by elk is absolutely flat at 14 years of age, every single cotton picking year. And I cannot believe that. And those prime age cows, well, you can look at this. This is what the data, where's the inflection point on that pink line? That's where the survival rate starts to dip. It's around 10 or 12. But they are just invincible. And I've seen it. Flying around an airplane, you should see wolves chasing a herd of elk. And every now and then, one of those elk from the herds, a cow, not a bull with antlers, but a cow, steps out of the herd and faces those wolves and even runs at them. And you should see those wolves go, "Not you, honey. Don't want anything to do with you." And in fact, the guy in the lower right, one time, got one of those elk, and she pinned him behind a tree for 10 minutes and wouldn't let him get out from behind the tree. And the helicopter flew in and was fanning the trees, and the trees were blowing sideways. And that elk was looking at the helicopter and to the guy. She was mad. And that night in the bar, he explained wildlife biology to me. Ain't no wolf gonna kill that cow. Ain't gonna happen. So that's the best I could do. So, again, I said I wasn't gonna do straight science. Arguably, There's a couple others that aren't bad. Greatest American writer of all time, Mark Twain. He summarized wolf biology. Supposing is good. That's humanity. There's been a lot of research done that we are not good at assessing reality. We're not that logical. We conquered the earth via stories and charisma. And if we got other people to believe our story and we create a little group of believers, it didn't matter if what you believe is right or wrong. You are organized and productive. And that's why we're successful. Mark Twain had it figured out. So that's what we do with wolves. If we don't know, we make it up. So that's what science does. But finding out is better. So that's what we're trying to do. So this is how we study wolves. And I have 4.5 minutes of video at the end. We have a GoPro camera on our helmets when we are darting wolves. I was supposed to be darting wolves all this week because the shutdown, it got moved to this week. And of course, the weather's been bad all week. You can't fly in snow and high winds. And so just looking at this picture, this is me in Pelican Valley in Yellowstone. My heart starts pounding. It's high stress, high adrenaline work. And we got a lot of work left to do, but I'll save that to the end. But the first thing you do when you catch a wolf, besides check that it's okay, is you look at his teeth, because the story of their life is in their teeth. So what do you think this is, an old wolf or a young wolf, middle-aged wolf? Very good. You guys could all be wolf biologists. Very young wolf, because there's not much staining and there's not much tooth breakage. I actually am scanning the audience here, and there's a guy in the audience who cleans our skulls for us, and this guy isn't, he just raised his hand. He is a true expert at wolf dentition, writes a very detailed report every time, and I read about 8 of his reports yesterday. And one thing you should know about this is rarely does a wolf come in without busted up teeth or busted up skulls. And this guy's in the audience, and he could put a better number on it, but I'm saying we got to analyze this. But it's probably over 80%. They got busted teeth, busted zygomatic arches, cracked skulls, and it's from getting kicked in the head by elk and bison all the time or getting bit by other wolves. But it's phenomenal. I'm looking through these reports yesterday, and I'm like, geez, oh, man. And I complain about a rough life. But their teeth tell a lot of the story. And then add their skull, and you got even more. So really, really interesting. And then we fly. And this is a guy who I could talk a long time about. It's poor taste to put a picture of yourself in the picture. But I flew, I haven't even calculated all, but several thousand hours with this guy. This is Roger Stradley. His first flight was 1952. I think he was 13 or 14 back in those days. Who cared? His first flight over Yellowstone was 1960. And he knew the park better than anybody I've ever come across. And there was not a flight I did with him that he wasn't excited to do it. He could not wait to get in the plane to see what we were going to find. Unfortunately, 2 years ago, he retired at 78. I guess I don't blame him for that. Occasionally, he'll show up to talks that I give in Bozeman. But he's been hard to replace. This photo was supposed to be in National Geographic magazine. They did a special issue in 2016. They mounted a camera on the strut. In a 45-minute flight, I took 800 pictures just clicking the remote camera. But this was a period of time when Raj had lost some of his certifications, and he couldn't do a government flight inside the park. So we had to fly around outside the park, and there was no snow. It was a dry winter. And National Geographic rejected this 2-page fold-out in their magazine because they said, Doug, it has to be 100% perfect. We don't do 99% for Nat Geo. And they wanted a blanket of white snow below. But I had to do this flight on my own time. I couldn't be a government employee when we did it. So we were just outside flying Paradise Valley around. Really cool to fly all that time with the window wide open. Anyways, I miss Roger a great deal. But this is once the wolf is caught and radioed, we spend a lot of time following him. And following him is really cool. I won't tell you how old I am, but I've been studying wolves since I was 18 years old. And you never get tired of seeing them or watching them. or thinking about them. You know, life is hard. I know all you know that. It's a struggle. And to look into another animal's life, kind of as a window. And again, they don't reveal their secrets. But how do they deal with it? What do they do? That is just a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I encourage all of you to try and do it with other creatures. What are their answers to this problem we call life? You know, people are kind of boring. I've heard all the stories. Wolves, I haven't. Really, really interesting. And so here are a few. That last slide I took a month ago. This is a slide I took about that long ago. This is a Junction Butte pack on an elk that died. We don't think the wolves or the bear killed it. That's a grizzly. This is rare to get wolves and grizzlies that close. Normally, the bear dominates the carcass, pushes the wolf off, and this is them feeding side by side. I thought it was cool. Took, you know, a bunch of pictures, and that bear look, you know, you just almost as good as the wolf look, not quite. And this one morning, we're flying. This is not Roger because it's the new pilot. And this is Gardner's Hole. This is what a wolf pup looks like in October. This is one of those frosty mornings where all the grass and vegetation is just pearly white. And seeing this pup work through on a game trail with his or her pack. And this is what I'm talking about. This is why wolves make nature wilder and better, that presence, that difference. And, you know, that's what makes Montana special. You know, that's our great difference from all the other states. What's our number two industry? Tourism? A few billion dollars a year, I don't know the numbers, but it's up there. They don't come here to see, you know, plazas and parking lots. They're coming here to see toothy critters like wolves, cougars, and grizzly bears that they can't get where they're from. So do we want to lose that? How do we hold on to it? So it's a big deal. And this happens to people a lot. This is one of the best places in the world to see wolves. It's Rick McIntyre. You probably know. He's watched more wolves than any human ever, probably. And he's part of giving these experiences to people. And this is an important consideration, too. I already talked about the Nat Geo issue, but there are economic benefits as well. This is the best place in the world to see wolves, Yellowstone Park. And there's an economic study done by University of Montana in Missoula, and it's about $35 million of economic activity per year. That's huge. And, you know, I've been at this a long time, and I'm kind of an idealist. I'm becoming less and less so as the years go by. But in the early years, I was like, if you asked me, why should we reintroduce wolves to Yellowstone? I would have said ecology and ethics. Do we have the right to wipe out another species from the face of the earth? And that was the goal. And now I'm kind of softened. We've benefited the most. This gives us pleasure. This makes our lives better. You should see the people in the park. I mean, where else can you go and find something real nowadays? I mean, geez, oh man, what the things we spend our time doing now are fake and artificial and just, I mean, just passing time, for crying out loud. So this is important for us. And, you know, I can't help but say this, and maybe I should say I'm giving this talk on my own time, but this is a bipartisan issue. I mean, I was going to the University of Idaho as an undergrad when Jim McClure was the Republican senator from Idaho. And he was the first one to suggest wolf reintroduction because he was like, we don't want these things to come in here on their own because if they do, they'll be a fully protected endangered species. We want to reintroduce them because that gives us flexibility. Then there's times when we can kill them. Then William Penn Mott, under Reagan, director of the Park Service, came in, and he got a button. I got one in my desk. It doesn't work anymore, but it was a button where the eyes lit up. And at the bottom, it said, it's in the eyes. A Reagan director of the Park Service pushing wolves like that. And then Wayne Owen from Utah carried the torch. A lot of preparation and research was done under the first Bush administration. As I mentioned, President Clinton was president when we brought him in. And then 60% of the wolf program in Yellowstone is supported by non-governmental dollars, grants, and donations. And the three biggest donors, two's a Republican, one's a Democrat. So if you want to like cross the aisle and talk about bipartisan issues, talk about wolves. Really, really, truly. And yeah, so this is maybe the middle ground that we're seeking. But I've stressed this. We're the biggest beneficiaries of this. And really what we're down to is how many of them are we going to allow? And so the subject of wolf hunting is a very important issue, and I'm not going to dive into that. I don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but we've got to figure a middle ground. Some social science indicates that wolf hatred trumps tolerance. No matter if you have hunting or not hunting, wolf hatred is still there. Others, most state game managers, would say that when there's hunting, my phone quits ringing. Is that being able to hunt a few wolves buys tolerance? This is a debate right now. There isn't a clear answer, but all the states in the West have instituted hunting possibly to gain social acceptance. And wolves can usually take a harvest. In some cases, it affects their social structure, but in other cases, it doesn't. So this is a big debate. And so probably, and the Canadian provinces and territories in Alaska have found to have wolves, you probably need to hunt them. But it needs to be a regulated hunt. It used to be unregulated. And wolf hatred is not a good way to manage anything. So we need to be careful. And what is the impact of this on park wolves? So the dots are where all the wolves that live primarily inside Yellowstone, and usually that's greater than 95%, where they have been killed legally outside the park. Some of these wolves have never left the park. They do, and within a few hours, they're dead. And so this is an issue that we discuss with the states frequently. The state of Montana started off with unlimited hunting on the north border of Yellowstone. And now they have created two hunt districts that have a quota of two, 313 and 316. And the issue here is these wolves are used to you. So they're not wary. It's not like a wolf that lives with people all the time. They know what you are. And so they're very wary. So these wolves, when they're being watched by you in the park, they leave the park and they're naive to hunting. And so they don't know where the line is. So we've got to have kind of a transition zone from complete protection to unlimited hunting. Because north of these two areas, there isn't a quota. And so we've worked out that protection. And so this is a sign for hope too. Our mission, preservation, means no use. A worthy policy. The state mandate is conservation, wise use, also a worthy mandate. But they clash. They clash. So we've had to compromise. And that's what wolves need more than ever. And again, I grew up idealizing wolves. I've had to give ground. But we've got to find some place in the middle. And that's why, and I garbled my message a little bit to you about wolf hunting, but to have wolves probably means you're going to have to hunt them, at least moderately, and for sure, controlling problem wolves. And the other thing, and I do get this occasionally, people come up to me who don't like wolves and go, what are you losing? You're losing nothing. You got a job from this. What are these people losing? I got a letter today, opened it, handwritten. They're America's resource. They're the world's resource. And I don't kill them. We come, we see them, and we leave. And the next person comes and sees them and leaves. And multiply that by several hundred thousand people a summer, a year. And the person who hunts them, it's that one person who gets it. Now, I don't know which is right, but I hear both sides. So when they say, you're not losing anything, tell that to them. Tell that to them. And not all those are regular wolf watchers who are out there every day. A lot of those are people from the American public, and that's their only day looking at wolves. And so that's an argument that we hear a lot in the park. I have one more scientific issue to cover, a couple stories, and then I'll show the video. But I was surprised. I thought we had covered, and I used the term we, the royal we. I wasn't there pre-Wolf. I didn't have anything to do with the setup. There's people in this room who did. One of them prominently is in the front, Norm Bishop, great friend. He was part of that setup. But one thing no one really looked at was, what are the wolves going to do to the ecosystem? And this has flared up to be one of the biggest scientific debates in the park. And I was amazed in some ways, I shouldn't say this on troubled waters here, but how simple really the points were that people were debating about. But people love to do that. We love to argue and go back and forth. But remember, I said at the beginning we killed off all the predators and the elk population burgeoned, and then park managers had to control the elk. Why'd they control the elk? Because they're damaging the vegetation. Almost every scientist I talked to agrees that woody vegetation was suppressed during most of the 20th century. I'm referring mostly to willow, aspen, and cottonwood. And primarily I'm going to talk about willow and aspen right now. Cottonwood's kind of a diverging story. The grasslands were different. People get the browsing mixed up with grazing all the time. Grazing is eating grass, browsing is eating wood. There's really good evidence that that heavy grazing stimulated the grassland, caused it to produce more. So there's two separate debates here. I'm going to talk primarily about willow and aspen. This is Lamar Valley, 1923, kind of prior to this period of control of elk, and before the elk started to suppress most of the woody vegetation. What I want you to notice here is the luxuriant vegetation along the stream banks. And a lot of people, a lot of critics of the park, I know them all. No, I'm just kidding. I know a lot of them, are like, look at that, what's wrong here? And then through the 20th century, elk browsing pretty much did this to willow, aspen, cottonwood. One of my favorite stories to tell media interviews is, you know, when I first started walking around the Northern Range, virtually every aspen and willow stem I saw was browsed, and it was at the level of my knee. And then they started to come back, and we get into the science debate, and I don't want to gloss over everything, because it's like, you know, like all of you, everybody's got a viewpoint. Every opinion matters. Science is like that too. They try and base it on evidence. But what happened here is scientists do science in different ways. Sometimes scientists are doing experiments. And when you set up an experiment, you get an answer to the experiment. It's great. That's called strong science. It's called the gold standard. Other people walk around Northern Yellowstone with a measuring tape, and they just measure vegetation across the landscape. That's not an experiment. It's generally held in lower esteem, but it's still data. It's still evidence. And it's looking at the whole landscape. So you get another different set of answers. You're not looking at it the same way. Have you ever had that happen to you in your life when you're talking to somebody? And so these people fought it out that, you know, this is happening, this isn't happening. But after about 20 years of that debate, they're finally concluding that, you know, in places, willow and aspen are coming back. And that's the first thing that they had to agree on. This is not a homogeneous response. It's a heterogeneous response. That means in some places, willow and aspen were coming back. In other places, they weren't. And so that was the first thing to agree on. The other thing was, it's not all due to wolves. You read the paper, and I'm blamed for this all the time. It's a wolf effect. Well, remember I said cougars came back and bears increased? And oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that the state of Montana thought there were too many elk in the Northern Yellowstone elk herd. So they hunted cow elk for 25 years to try and reduce the herd. So there were a lot of things going on that caused the elk population to go down. And that's the first thing you needed, was elk to go down to reduce that browsing pressure. And then when willow and aspen came back, you got things like beavers and songbirds, especially the lower left, that's a Wilson's warbler. And on the right, that's a willow flycatcher. They're willow obligates. In other words, they won't nest in anything but willow. And I work with birds in Yellowstone too, and we're seeing them come back. They weren't as abundant 20 years ago. This is an aspen stand. You can see the big thing that the researchers who study the aspen like to point out is there's two age classes here, old and young. There's nothing in the middle. There's no continuous recruitment because of all that elk browsing middle part of the 20th century. And so this is my punchline for what we're calling the trophic cascade debate. It's probably something to do. The answer lies with you have tiered or nested limiting factors. So willow and aspen to a degree cottonwood were limited by too much elk browsing. When you reduce elk browsing, whether it's because of fewer elk or changes in behavior, and most of our work supports the fewer elk idea, you lower that browsing pressure, then the next limiting factor becomes relevant. And in this case, it's water. And so if you reduce elk browsing, but there's not adequate water, you don't get a response. And that was a big part of what these researchers were arguing about. And the last thing they're arguing about is Yellowstone is not fixed. In other words, you can't have Yellowstone early 1900s with carnivores, with willow and aspen, with fewer elk, and then you get rid of the carnivores and the elk take off and they affect the vegetation. It changed Yellowstone. We call this an ecological state. It flipped it to an elk grassland state from a carnivore willow aspen beaver state. It flipped to something else. It just doesn't flip back when you bring back the original inhabitants. It goes off in a different direction. It happens to people in life. Who changes back to their younger days? So this was hard. Nested factors, different experimental approaches, how we talk about wolves, and is Yellowstone fixed or not? And once we kind of started talking more, and it's tough getting these folks in the same room, you can inch towards a solution. So, end of the talk, and then the video. But this is a quote by a economic psychologist, I think I got that right, Daniel Kahneman. No one ever made a decision because of a number. They need a story. I have spent my life trying to put a number on this stuff. And I guess I've wasted a lot of time. So I'm going to finish with some stories. Because remember what I said mid-talk? We are evolutionarily successful because we told good stories. And that's the only thing we really get and remember. So you'll probably forget everything in my talk, except a couple stories. This is the story of 9/11, and this is that work by that guy sitting in the middle of the room. He's got photo credit there. But 9/11 was born in 2010, dispersed from the Blacktail Pack, helped start the Junction Butte Pack, lived vigorously for a couple seasons, lost his mate and a whole litter of pups his second season. But at the top there, you can see him in his kind of pinnacle of health. There's three color phases of wolves, gray, black, and white. And the classic wolf is a gray wolf. And there he is. And, you know, a beautiful sight in nature is nothing like a healthy male wolf. And there he was. And then all of a sudden, he started to decline. And his fur started to look ratty. He started to limp. And we're like, what the heck happened? We watched him. It happened in April. He started to look bad. And then in September, he was by himself. He found an elk in the Lamar River, in Lamar Valley, and he attacked that elk. It took him a half dozen attempts. Grabbed a hold of her neck. She went in the river to try and get away. Elk do that a lot. They go to water. If it's chest deep, it will work. If it's not chest deep, it might not. But he fought and struggled with that elk. Finally, he killed her by himself. And September's the worst time of year trying to kill an elk. They're in their best shape of the year because they've been feeding on green grass and forbs all summer. And sure enough, another pack, Prospect Peak Pack, moves in. And they look at the situation. They see he's the only wolf there. And they take the elk from him, and they start feeding on it, and then they kill him. And, you know, we're like, wow. And some people saw it. I wasn't there. And it was just dramatic. It's the classic wolf stretch when they pull them off the ground and they just pull them end to end. And so we went and picked them up. And we, you know, we knee cropped him as best as we could. And he was decrepit. He had some sores in his mouth. He was bad on gimpy on three legs. And then we sent in his skull. And the guy who's here called me on the phone and said, you're not going to believe this, but his jaw is broken in half. So we surmise the story here is that he got kicked in the jaw in April, and that happens a lot with wolves. And it broke his jaw in half in April, and he lived 4 more months. And on the last day of his life, he killed an elk. And I think of that so often, and I hung the phone up, and I couldn't believe it. And then Craig brought the skull down, and I looked at the skull, and I was shaken. How did he live 4 months with his jaw broken in half? I mean, can you imagine the pain? We'd be in the hospital on IV fluids with multiple surgeries to try and restore that jaw. And he walked around all summer and killed an elk his last day. And it's an amazing story. And actually, I shouldn't say this because it probably won't get accepted. I submitted it to the New York Times, and they're thinking about it. You know, they're thinking about publishing it because it's an amazing story, because it's what goes on in nature every day and we never know about it. It's out there happening all the time. This is 755. This is a little bit easier story to tell, but the ending might not be any happier. And I think that's the way it goes with wolves in nature. Happy endings are hard to come by. But this guy was paired with a female that some call the most famous wolf in the world, 832, the 06 female, and she got shot legally in Wyoming outside the park, so he lost a mate. And the next wolf in line to take her place in their social hierarchy was his daughter. Wolves don't inbreed, so he left the pack. His next mate, he bred with, she got killed by another pack. So he goes through mate number two. He pairs with another female, and we're all hopeful. I forget how long they hung around together, a few weeks, maybe more than that. And then they split apart. And there was a picture of Rick in the talk. And I went up to Rick one day and I said, you know, what the heck happened? You know, male meets female. They had a little vacant area to live in. You know, what happened? And Rick goes, well, you know, Doug, she was quite a bit younger than he was. You know, who hasn't had that happen to him? You know, young gal leaves old guy. Sure, I got that quickly. So mate number three, and then he pairs again. And this time it looks like it's going to work because he sets up shop in Hayden Valley, has a litter of pups, raises them successfully. Next summer has another litter of pups. And you're like, yes, nature does have happy endings. And then sure enough, three male wolves from the neighboring pack, Molly's pack, move in and take over his rendezvous site. They're tolerant of the pups. Of course, they're tolerant of the resident female, but they're not tolerant of him. So he has to leave his mate and pups. He actually snuck in to visit them when these three big males weren't there. And then he would leave again. And eventually, he just left completely. These three big males came in and usurped his pack. What was she thinking again? You know, like, see you, honey. But this is nature. So he left, and then he came up to the Northern Range again, and right about then, his radio collar quit working. And so maybe appropriately, we don't know the end of that story. I also have a soft spot in my heart for him because he started off as a pure black wolf. And you can see what happened to his hair, kind of like mine. But these two wolves, Delta Pack, most remote part of the lower 48, 32 miles from a road, which I think is kind of pathetic. That's all the further you can get from a road. Brothers, caught them 1 year, 2010, Super Bowl Sunday. I missed the Super Bowl, very upset about that. 760, weighed 116 pounds. The next year, I mistakenly darted him again, same spot. I was after a wolf that had a collar that had quit, There's nothing worse than a wolf wearing a collar to quit. Super Bowl Sunday again. This was a really bad run of Sundays. And I got him because I darted the wrong wolf. And he had gained from 116 to 148. Empty stomach. So sometimes when you give wolves a drug, they vomit. I hate to be rude, but you know they puke and you know chunks of meat come out. And I was holding this guy's head in my hands and nothing but bile was coming out while he was puking. So he had no meat in his stomach. That's a pure 148. They can put 20 pounds of meat in their stomach. So it can really throw off the scale. And I've had many, many people come up to me and say, you know, these are Canadian wolves. They're much bigger than the wolves that were here. These things weigh 180, 190 pounds. That's the single biggest wolf we've caught in Yellowstone right there, 148. And you don't do very well when you tell someone they're lying. So all I say is, you know, I fly around Yellowstone in a helicopter with a scale. And the biggest wolf we've caught is 148, that guy right there. And you know, the other amazing thing is I've handled over 600 wolves in my life. And so seeing a wolf like that in the snow is just another day at work. I can sometimes walk up and kick them and jump back in the helicopter and just go home. And I wanted to go home that day because it was a Super Bowl. You know, it starts at 4:30. I thought I was going to make the game. And then I stopped and I looked at that wolf and I looked at the forest behind and I thought, what is the big deal? And what would that forest be like without him? And why? Why has this critter done what it's done to people for so long? And you just look at him. And I'm biased. But you look at his magnificence and his beauty and what he means to that forest and what that means to us symbolically and spiritually. Those woods are empty and vacant without that guy and his pack. But that's my opinion. You decide that for yourself. And you decide things like this. Do you know what it's like to hear a wolf when they're doing that? This is Pelican Valley. This is National Geographic again. I rode out and we jammed a stake in the ground and we put a camera out looking. That took 30,000 photos. It was a $1,200 card, National Geographic. And that's one of the pictures it took. And I got to ask you, as Montanans, who live amidst wolves, who struggle with wolf management and wolf hatred and wolf lovers, what would that picture be like without those two wolves? Here's another picture from the same camera in the corner there. You can see a wolf, and that white thing in the middle is not the sun, that's the moon. So it's up for you to decide, do we really have something here that's special, or is this just another problem animal we should do with what many other people have done? So I'm back to thinking about science. This is the subject of this lecture, isn't it? We should prefer approximate answers to the right questions, not precise answers to the wrong questions. You know, it's tough. It's tough. So I'll stop there. It's hard to do just science with wolves. It's so, so laden with what we think about them or what we want to think about them.